Welcome back to the Renaissance, Ray. This is episode 124, I believe. AKA Leonardo da Vinci part something.
We don't know. Insert name.
We never know. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. How are you, Ray?
You know, I know what you think. You think podcast, or you think Bentleys, supermodels, pools. Well, one of those was true for me. It's a pool. It's an inflatable, cheap Walmart pool, but it's still a pool. So I have begun to live the life of one of those top tier podcasters.
How come you're still white and pasty? You're not getting any sun in that pool?
Well, I think my... either you can call it my toga or my KKK sheet keeps me. No, I put on the hat, the glasses, the sun, the spray. I am paranoid about, you know, messing this up. Who would want to mess this up? So I cover completely. Anyway, how about you?
Well, yesterday, Chrissy and I went to the art gallery here in Brisbane to see what they call the European Masterpieces Exhibition. Oh. Tying in with the Renaissance. I thought, fuck, this is a tax dodge. I'll go and claim this back in the tax. Come from the New York Metropolitan Museum of Art. They've got this wonderful, wonderful collection, or so they said. It turns out it's really, it should be billed as the minor European paintings that the New York Met figured they probably wouldn't miss if they got lost on a shipping container piracy somewhere.
Third rate artists.
Yeah. Well, I mean, at the end of the day, there was some first rate artists. There was Caravaggio and there was a Van Gogh and a Monet and a couple of Renoirs and a Rembrandt. But they were the ones you've never seen before, not even in books, because the deep cuts. Yes, the deep cuts.
It's like, who? He did that?
Yeah.
Did he cut?
Right. Is that very early in his career?
Yeah. Was he 13?
Yeah.
And didn't discover that he was really right-handed. I mean, I'm not impressed.
But I tell you, when we got there and was buying our tickets, the lady said to me, "Oh, there's an audio commentary that you can listen to on your phone if you want." And I was like, "Yeah, fuck yeah, that's a great idea." So I got the commentary thing, put my AirPods in, and the commentaries were like, "In this painting, there's a man with he's looking at a dog. The dog is looking at a cat. The cat is looking at a bird. The bird is yellow.
Right. Circle of life."
That's it. There's a tree. Okay. Right. And I was like,
on to the next one.
Did you make this commentary for blind people who can't see the I can see the fucking painting. I don't want you to describe what's in the painting.
Give me something.
Yeah, I said to Chrissy, like, if this was Ray and I doing the commentary, I'd be like, I think that tree represents his dick. And, he's touching the tree. It's like he's jerking off over the dog. The dog represents... it was so boring. I listened to like three of the painting commentaries and I was like, I just can't do this anymore. This is so fucking boring. What are you doing?
I shan't be doing it. Yeah.
Yeah, I shat and I shan't. so that was that. In other news, I got a clean bill of health.
That's right. I saw that. Congratulations.
After all of the,
scare?
The GP telling me that I was like probably going to die any moment.
You were making out your will and Ray, I'm leaving this to you. Just flipped me off. Yeah. But other than that.
Flipped you
off. You were going through the end of life.
You were auditioning new co-host. Tony was getting ready to bring Taylor in as his co-host.
Oh, you saw that, did you?
Cardiologist. They ultrasounded me, made me run on treadmills, did the whole thing, and at the end of it said, "You're perfectly fine. There's no blockages. Your cholesterol levels are perfect. Good. Your fucking blood pressure's perfect." In fact, he said, I wrote it down here. Uh-oh. "You're a man of outstanding beauty and infinite grace, striking and handsome, and your great presence brought comfort to the most troubled soul."
That sounds right.
No, wait. That's what Vasari said about Leonardo da Vinci. Sorry.
Same thing.
Moved over into my notes here. He was a man of outstanding beauty and infinite grace. He was striking and handsome, and his great presence brought comfort to the most troubled soul.
Yeah. Can I, real quick, we know he's talented. We know he's talented in many different fields. But if you had told me before we started this that he was really good looking and had a perfect body, he's a total package, I would have said, you know, let's do a podcast and let's nitpick Leo to death. Let's find all the things he didn't do well and let's focus on that for 200 episodes. That would make me feel a lot better. So this guy's just a total fucking package.
Yeah, you got to imagine he's got the face of Brad Pitt, the body of 1986 Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yes.
And, yes. Without even trying. Yeah, yeah. And can paint. Yeah. And not only that, everyone loves him. Everyone
yes. thinks funny, he's just engaging, yeah, charming,
generous.
Very generous. He could draw
vegetarian.
You in. Didn't give a fuck about money. Didn't want to hurt animals. Wouldn't hurt a flea. Would walk around an ant. Just one of those people. We need more of those people.
He's literally Gandhi mixed with Jesus, mixed with Che Guevara, mixed with the greatest artist of all time. Who's the greatest? Oh, he was. So he's like, you read these movies, like, what? How come I never knew this about him? I expected him to be this crotchety, old, get out of my fucking way, I'm a genius guy. No, not at all.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was going to say, I've been telling people, you know, lately, he had the charm of Ray Harris and the intelligence and good looks of Cameron Riley. He was like the two of
us. It's like if we had a child. If we had a child and we finally argued and we thumb wrestled and we decided who was going to carry it for 9 months.
Who was on top? Cam says bottom.
Who's on top? It's like if we had a child. I mean, he's just... But the fact that he's nice and that he's sensitive and he's caring, that's what really pisses me off. He's not faking it. He's not being insincere. He's not just ass-kissing. He seems like a genuinely pleasant, passive, easygoing, non-judgmental person. I can't relate to that. I work with you.
And something you can relate to, he also knew how to suck a dick. So...
I can relate. Yeah. Everything. But this is another. Ask you this real quick. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say this is another quote from Vasari. His disposition was so lovable that he commanded everyone's attention. He was so pleasing in conversation that he attracted to himself the hearts of men.
So he's a puppy dog, but with Brad Pitt's body. He's a puppy. I mean, what's not to love? You know, whatever. He walks into a room. Hey, everybody! Leo's here. Hey, Leo.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway,
you were going to ask me a question?
Well, just that there's a chance, there is a slight chance that Vasari might be exaggerating some of this stuff about how nice he was or how good looking he was or how perfectly tight his curls and his hair was, whatever, fuck him. But when you have several different sources saying he was a pleasant gentleman, he was fun to be around, he was stimulating, I mean, he was just everything and he would never say anything mean. You really do get a sense of this guy who is just dripping with talent, who might not even understand how much talent he has, doesn't care about money. He values knowledge, so he chases that to hell with money. Like you said, he spends money on his friends or whatever. And so, again, he's just the total package. You wonder if he really gets a sense of how incredible he was, or was he just too caught up in trying to fill all the void of knowledge in his life? And I don't think he got a sense of... how he came across. He was just happy that everybody liked him and he liked everybody.
I think he was, I mean, obviously he sort of had an interesting childhood. He was a bastard, as we know, and was attracted to the arts very early. But, you know, Vasari, you know, didn't necessarily have nice things to say about other artists like, you know, Lippi. Oh, there was a Lippi painting, an early Lippi painting at the exhibition I went to before he fucked the nun and ran off with the nun. But I tell you what, it was really interesting going. It was the first time I've been to a major exhibition like that of European paintings, Renaissance paintings, since we started doing the show. like my ability to, you know, I understood a bunch of the artists, where they fit in, to be able to look at the transition from the gothic through to the humanist elements that are appearing in it. It was, this podcast has really paid off for me to be able to appreciate, I think, what I'm looking at when I go to these things. You know, Vasari didn't have nice things to say about a lot of the artists. A lot of the artists that he that we've talked about so far, Brunelleschi, Alberti, Lippi, a lot of the guys that were
trouble.
A lot of just troublemakers, irascible, you know. Drink, alcoholics, fucking prostitutes, just very, very difficult. So I don't think it's like Vasari's blowing smoke up everybody's ass. And as you said, we have a lot of contemporary stuff that has survived. People who knew Leonardo or knew people who knew Leonardo. Vasari's writing a generation later, but a lot of people who knew him who said the same thing. Yeah, no, like just great guy, just the best. He's the best, Jerry, the best. One of those is Paolo Giovio. He was a near contemporary who met Leonardo in Milan. He wrote, he was friendly, precise, and generous with a radiant, graceful expression. His genius for invention was astounding, and he was the arbiter of all questions relating to beauty and elegance, especially in pageantry. So he had lots of friends. There were surviving letters and writings from dozens of prominent intellectuals in Milan and Florence that say he was the companion that they loved and valued the most. He dressed colorfully. We talked about this before. He loved looking a million bucks. He would sometimes wear, according to one contemporary, a rose-colored cloak, which came only to his knees, though at the time long vestments were the custom.
Check out his calves.
Show off a little bit of flesh. As he grew older, he grew a long beard, and you know most of the self portraits that we've seen of him, you know, he's got the long hair and the long beard, looking a little bit like Jesus. According to one custom, his beard came to the middle of his breast and was well-dressed and curled.
Of course it was.
Yeah. He used to walk around at home with curlers in his beard.
Had to get up an hour early just to do that. But it was worth it because he looked stunning.
Right. Do you do that? What's your beard regimen, Ray?
I get up and I go, done. And it looks it because I spent 3.5 seconds on it. No, but when I read that part about the beard, I'm like, this isn't some guy who's getting older, letting himself go and say, fuck it, I don't know, I don't care anymore. From what we could tell, he was still thin. He was still in reasonably good shape, had a good body. I just think it was a part of an affectation for him. He, you know, whether it's just standing out in a crowd, because let's face it, he's wearing a rose-colored robe and it's not long enough. Between that and his beard, I think people could just be in a crowd and go, aha, there's Leo right there in case you were looking for him. I don't know, but he wasn't letting himself go, but I think he was certainly embracing the fact that he was getting older, and maybe he just liked beards. I don't know, but this is truly not someone who's just given up on life. If anything, he's started to come into his prime.
Let me ask you a question about beards. When was the last time you were clean shaven for a long period of time?
Oh my God. It has been years. I tried to shave a couple times and I got read the Riot Act by Heather, Kiki, and Sophie. No, it's been, 7 years? I don't know.
We've been together 7 years. Coming up eight.
Something.
So you met me and you grew the beard and you haven't taken it off since. So what? Why do you have the beard? Is it just you're trying to hide something?
My
disability. You don't have any hair on the top of your head, so you figure you get some on the bottom?
None on the top, none on the testicles. This is the only place I got it, so.
And the back.
I'm going with it. I'm going with it. No, I've always just, I wanted a beard when I was a kid and I couldn't have one because puberty had set in. And
you wanted
since
a
it
beard
set in 7 years ago.
When you were set in when you were 45.
I want a beard, mama. Yeah, no, it came in late 40s and ever since then I've been celebrating. So.
right. Anyway. But yes, he was generous, as we've said before. According to Vasari, he was so generous that he sheltered and fed all his friends, rich or poor. This is obviously at some point in Milan where he started to get money. Like, we know he moved to Milan when he was around 30. At that stage, he was broke as shit. He was broke as a podcaster. He and then we know that it took years in Milan before he got any work, but then eventually got involved in the pageants, as we said in previous episodes. I assume that's where the money came in. He was designing weddings for Sforza and other members of the elite. So that probably paid very well. And once he got money, he was just giving it away to everyone. Just he was Tony Kynesting it. He was just like, you know, bringing people in. Don't worry about it. I got you on this. Not motivated at all by wealth or material possessions. And in his notebooks, he wrote that he didn't like men who desire nothing but material riches and are absolutely devoid of the desire for wisdom, which is the sustenance and truly dependable wealth of the mind. So he cared about wisdom and philosophy, money, material possessions, didn't matter to him.
Yeah, which partially explains why he kept jumping from subject to subject, because he would just find things utterly fascinating. Oh, you know, let me go. Oh, that reminds me of this. And he's like you. Everything would lead to a deep fucking dive. Oh, my God. And he's like, oh, I don't know anything about birds. Let me go look at birds or feathers or whatever. But the one thing that I thought was cool, and I think most people would fail this test. Tell me what you think. So he's got a little bit of money coming in. He's got friends coming over. And as we're going to find out, some of those friends are, I wouldn't say his intellectual equals, but they're like him. He's not just bringing over idiots. He's bringing over very smart men. But here's the part that I liked. We've explained he's a pacifist. We've explained that he loves animals. He was setting animals free. He got thrills out of being with animals, sometimes more than he got with being humans. But at the same time, he would take his or hard-earned money. He would go to the shop or have assistant go to the shop, buy meat, come back for his guests. So he's like, I don't believe in eating meat. I don't believe in animal cruelty, but you guys do. And guess what? I'm not judging you. If you want a chicken leg, motherfucker, I'll get you a chicken leg. I'll get you whatever you want. But me, myself, I'm just going to sit here with vegetables. I think most people, and you've seen people like this today, oh, I don't eat meat. And then they give you a look because you're like the devil because you've got a chicken breast in your hand or whatever. But he was truly non-judgmental, sharing, and he was letting everybody do their own thing, and he wasn't judging them. He was just living by his own code, and they had to live by their code. And he seemed to be okay with that, which is not where we're at all in today's society.
Shout out to Effie, who was in Europe with us. Gave you a hard time, didn't she?
I touched a bum meat one time. Oh, the meat. Yeah. Yeah, that too. Yeah. Okay, now it's getting hot because I'm thinking about her and eating meat. But but he literally wasn't judging people. Whereas in this day, it's like, I don't believe in this, so none of you should be doing it. He's just a class act all the way around.
Vasari said he possessed nothing and worked little, but he always kept servants and horses. The horses brought him much delight, as did all animals. Right. Often when passing the places where birds were sold, he would take them with his own hand out of their cages, and having paid to those who sold them the price that was asked, he let them fly away into the air, restoring to them their lost liberty.
Like Braveheart. What would you do with freedom? And then he lets the bird go. Here's my thing. You don't know. Most people don't know this. I had to dig deep. But there was a bird marketeer on the same street where Leonardo lived. He had a couple of homing pigeons. Leonardo would come by, pay for them. He'd let them go. Next day, the pigeons are back. He'd just paint the birds. He didn't know. Leonardo would come by, free him. Again, this guy made a killing off Leonardo for the years that he was in Milan. That's a little known historical fact. Carrier pigeons.
So yes, according to one of his friends, he would not kill a flea for any reason whatsoever, and he preferred to dress in linen so as not to wear something dead. As you said, even though he was a vegetarian for most of his life, his shopping lists, as they're recorded in his notebooks, included meat, but he was buying that for people in his household that ate meat. Because just because he was vegetarian didn't mean that everyone else had to. A Florentine traveller to India wrote that the people there do not feed on anything that is blood, nor will they allow anyone to hurt any living thing like our Leonardo da Vinci. So wow. He was famous for being a vegetarian and an animal lover.
Rose-colored even in his days. Big giant beard, beautiful body, animal lover. I mean, this guy, I mean, if they had him at the time, he would have had the John Lennon colored glasses. But anyways, it's just a fucking hippie who's smarter than God himself.
Just a fucking hippie. That's your one-line biography on Leonardo da Vinci.
Leo was just a fucking hippie.
Just a fucking hippie.
With a ZZ Top beard. Next. What are we doing next?
In his notebooks, he made passionate arguments advocating vegetarianism. At one point, he wrote of humans, "If you are, as you have described yourself, the king of the animals, why do you help other animals only so that they may be able to give you their young in order to gratify your palate?"
Yeah, it's a good question.
Fair point. Peter Singer asked the same question. No, Peter Singer on my show years ago, talking about rights for animals.
When you call it animal husbandry, I think it sounds better up until the point, again, where you cut their throats or kill them or however these various animals are killed for their meat. So, yeah, that, he's making a good point. If you are the
It's not the way you use animal husbandry, though, when you say, "I'm marrying my goat. I'm now her husband." So this is technically, love between man and wife here.
What I do with the animals, and trust me, they've told me this, they get over it in about a half a day. So
no harm, no foul. You don't cut their throat, but after a couple of weeks, they're starting to wish you would.
Kill me. Are you into necrophilia? Kill me. I can't take it anymore. Anyway.
By the way, I was reading a book last night called... I'll give it to you because I know you're going to love this book.
Yeah.
It's called... Oh, shit. Erotica Universalis. Universalis. Erotica Universalis. By...
Which chapter Gyle, is
the... Uh-huh. Giles Narette. It's a Taschen book, the art label Taschen. And it's a collection of... erotic images going right back to ancient Egypt through Greece and Rome and, right through the Renaissance and the Middle Ages and the Renaissance and up into sort of, 19th century erotic art. And what I loved was in the some of the Greek pottery. There's Greek pottery from 400 BCE of guys fucking donkeys and of women getting fucked by bulls and donkeys and horses and the whole stuff. Yeah.
Right, right, right.
So they were painting, the Greeks were painting bestiality, pictures on their pottery. I was like, you never see that in museums. I like that.
No, more of that. It's in the back. It's behind the beads. You know what I'm saying? It's no.
I also downloaded a similar book called. That's what I do for The Little Book of Pussy by Diane Hansen, a Lilliputian library of labial loveliness, and it sort of is the history of vagina worship, I guess.
Right.
But I found out something that I didn't know. There's a place in Queensland about 5 hours from here that I've been to a couple of times called Carnarvon Gorge. Right. There is a wall there that I didn't know about, which is called the Wall of 1,000 Vulvas, where there's this – it's just – and I've seen high-res photos of it. There is carved into this wall 1,000 vulvas. They date it to, I think, about 3,500 years ago. The Aboriginals here, the Indigenous Australians, were carving these things on the walls. And according to this book, I know we're getting a little bit off the track here, but it's such so unlikely for us to get off the track. But the oldest human art, is hands and animals and vaginas. There's like early prehistoric human cultures were all vagina worshippers, and then they moved on to cocks, and cock worship then became the thing. Oh, it was once you hit ancient Egypt and on through, it's mostly cock worship, Priapus, etc., that we've talked about in our Caesar show. But I think we're coming full circle now. I think we're getting back to vagina worship. Anyway.
Well,
I got to go next time I go to Carnarvon, George. I got to go check out the Wall of 1,000 Vulvas. You can come with me and we can try some of them out or something.
Road trip, and I will wear the appropriate clothes. I was just telling Heather today when we took the dog for a walk. I was telling about the Middle Ages. So much has been lost, and you know there's still stuff that we don't know how the Romans were able to do it. Like some of their buildings are still standing around 1,000 years later, whatever. It sounds to me like one of the things that we lost during the Dark Ages was, for a while there, I think, we lost a true appreciation of the vulva and various parts of the women. And obviously, if we're going to take the time to paint them on walls, they're pretty important to us, because that's art. And it sounds like we're going back to that now. So I'm sorry we missed 1,500 years or whatever of not worshiping women's bodies, but it sounds like they had their act together back then.
So. You've seen this. Like, I sculpted that some while ago. That's my, sculpture that I
Nice. Keep here. You either got good skill or a really good memory, and I'm going to leave that right there.
Hunter, one of my sons, was in my office the other day, and he saw that, and he's like, okay.
That's a conversation starter. Or enter. Yeah. It depends on how you look at it. Nice vulva.
He goes, why do you have that? And I goes, I was doing some plaster work with Fox. Yeah, for people who aren't watching the video feed, it's a plaster mold of a vagina that I did.
Yes. A beautiful vulva. If I may say. Yeah.
Artistic. Thank you.
Very aesthetically pleasing.
Thank you. As are vaginas.
Yes. Yeah.
Where were we? Oh, yes. Leonardo da Vinci. So he referred to a vegetarian diet as simple food. And urged everyone to, I mean, while you say he didn't force people in his household to do it, he wrote in his notebook, "Does not nature bring forth enough simple food things to satisfy your hunger? Or if you cannot content yourself with simple things, can you not do so by blending these simple foods together to make an infinite number of compounds? Throw them in the blender," he said. "Fry them up with a little bit of olive oil." It's basically the Mediterranean diet.
Right. You get the microwave. So all natural people, all natural.
Yeah. He invented the microwave and the blender in order to
probably
promote vegetarianism. He's
not harassing people. Yeah, go ahead.
No, he's writing in his notebooks, but he's not harassing people. He's writing down his thoughts. But that was his thought. Look, there's enough vegetables. You don't need to eat anything else. There's plenty of vegetables. You can eat vegetables. They'll satisfy you. You don't need to worry about it. Yeah. And his rationale was, like, his reason for being vegetarianism was being a vegetarian was based on morality.
Exactly.
You know, but based on science, because he figured that plants, unlike animals, don't feel pain, so it was morally justifiable to eat plants, and not animals.
Well, he can be as objective and scientific as he wants. And basically what he's saying is like, I know you can dress up food and you can make it taste wonderful and all that stuff. But, you know, as far as sustenance, you've got plants and we've got enough. So quit killing the animals. That's nice enough for him to say. Clearly, he was less objective when it comes to the sweet, tight ass of a 10-year-old. So we'll be getting to that soon. So.
Don't jump ahead too much.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm done.
I know you want to get into sweet 10-year-olds' asses, but just hold back for a second.
I'll hold back.
He came to the conclusion that the reason animals feel pain and plants don't is because animals move around and plants don't. So plants don't need a concept of pain. Although I would dispute that. There are plants that will close up their leaves and close up different things if you touch them to protect. Yeah, that's maybe, I don't know if you define that as pain, but it's something.
Do they feel exactly a movement? And I think generally he's right, but do we even know today if plants have the necessary, I guess they don't, nerves and whatever else in the brains? They don't have brains. So I guess they don't feel pain. So I guess it's okay to kill plants? Aren't they a living thing?
Yeah, he said nature has given sensibility to pain to living organisms that have the power of movement in order to preserve those parts which might be destroyed by movement, and pain is not necessary in plants. So
if it can't move, I can eat it. Go ahead.
Yeah, including, you know, a paraplegic, quadriplegic. They can't move. It's all good. What has this convinced you to be a vegetarian, Ray?
I did do 3 months of mostly salad. No, I was going to tell you some bullshit story. No. What about you? No.
No, I was vegetarian for 10 years. I was vegan for 10 years. Yeah,
oh, wow.
My 20s. I was vegan.
Good for you.
Yeah, and these days I'm on the Mediterranean diet, which is mostly vegetables, bit of fish, very rare sort of red meat. I like vegetarianism. I don't know that I care enough about animals. Well, I should, though. I feel guilty that I don't. Maybe I'm a psychopath.
I feel bad that I don't feel guilty. Is that something?
Yeah, that means you are a psychopath. Yeah.
Oh, well, I knew that going in. So I'm good. All right. I'm good. You know, I do have to ask, what do you think of his idea? If it can move on its own power, then it can feel pain. I mean, without obviously he couldn't really test that with the way we can test it today, but that's not a bad observational idea to come up with, again, because he was always observing everything around him.
Yeah, no, it's a pretty good observation, I guess. If things need to move, they need pain. No, it's
muscles, bones, tendons.
I guess
to move.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah.
The point is, he's noticing even little things like this, and he's thinking them through, and he's writing them down. So he's doing better than most people are.
All right, let's get to your 10-year-old. I know you're excited.
He's not my, damn it. Hold on. What, Cheryl? The lawyer wanted me to remind you he's not my 10-year-old. Okay, no, so when Leo was 38, we could, a little bit past his prime? I don't know, but from what we can tell by the records, he's still spry, athletic, thin, attractive guy. On July 22nd, 1490, a beautiful young companion comes to live with Leo. He's only 10 at the time. And I guess he's supposed to be an assistant or a pupil or a student of Leo's. But if it is, it quickly becomes the love boat. That's all I know.
His name is Gian Giacomo Caprotti da Orno, a.k.a. Sally. Is what Leonardo ends up calling him, which means little devil.
Yeah.
And he would be Leonardo's companion pretty much for the rest of his life, the next, 30-odd years.
Right.
Vasari describes Sally as a graceful and beautiful youth with fine curly hair in which Leonardo greatly delighted.
I got to ask, when you're looking for your next... is a protege? Is that the word I'm looking for? I don't know, student, whatever. Do you consider the talent of their skills, the level of their skills, or the tight curls and the tight ass? I mean, what do you look for in someone that you want to pass all your knowledge on to?
I'm not even touching that. I'm not going there.
That's probably no, what would you like to put in? What would you like to instill in them besides seeing?
Yeah.
But go ahead. Sorry. So he's got this 10-year-old. Go ahead.
Yeah, like he sometimes refers to him as my pupil, but he's not very clear in his notebooks about the original, like why he moved in, where, what the deal was, what the arrangement was.
He's a sculptor, he's a painter, he's a musician. What's going on here?
He turns up, though, in dozens of Leonardo's drawings and notebook sketches over the years. And he refers to him as my pupil, but Sally was never more than sort of a mediocre artist, according to most of the scholars and historians. He only produced a few paintings that we're aware of. Maybe Leonardo meant he was his pupil at sucking a dick. It was like, I'm going to Teach him everything I know. Ah, painting. Yeah, yeah. Well, he can paint too, but...
We'll get to the painting. We'll get to it. Got to work our way up.
Priorities. Yeah, you got to start at the bottom. And by the bottom, I mean my bottom.
Now, to be clear, let's be absolutely clear, or as Obama, let me be clear. We are not talking about Leo stooping a 10-year-old. There does seem, and I won't go too far, but there does seem to be a gap of years before their relationship, whatever you want to call it, became something more than professional. But it does seem that he was a very beautiful, well put together young boy. The hair, the skin, the looks, and everything, like a lot of 10-year-olds. And he just seems to have caught Leo's eye. You know, he came from a poor family. So this is technically a pretty good opportunity for Salai to learn a skill. And maybe one day, because the idea is to learn the skill, become a master yourself, and then maybe you can help out your family. So for right now, he's just a really cute kid who maybe got some potential, but he's really lucked out because now he's going to be working with the one and only Leonardo. Hopefully it works
out. Yeah. We do know that Salai was born in 1480, around about the time that Leonardo moved to Milan. Right. And his father, Pietro di Giovanni, was a tenant of Leonardo's vineyard near a place called Porta Vercellina in Milan. So Leonardo knew the family, they knew him, and I guess he was attracted to the kid. He thought he'd make a good model. He needed someone to sweep up around the place, whatever it is.
Yeah.
He brought him in, and as you say, at some stage they became lovers. We don't exactly know how old Salai was, but he probably would have been not much. I mean, maybe 13, 14, 15, something like that, which, as we know, was very acceptable in, certain circles, going right back to ancient Greece, and even in Florence. Yeah. Like the relationship between a young boy and an older man in homosexual circles was considered fine. Women, obviously girls were getting married off at 13, 14. So
why not boys?
Not boys, right?
Now,
Lomazzo was a Milanese painter, grew up there in the 1500s. He knew one of Leonardo's students. He was like a generation after Leonardo.
Right.
He wrote a book in 1560 called The Book of Dreams, and in The Book of Dreams there's this imaginary conversation between the ancient Greek sculptor Phidias and Leonardo. Tell me everything you know about Phidias, Ray. Your time starts now. Go.
Something to do with Phidias and Fern. No, I think it's a cricket. Anyway, so Phidias, I think he lives from like 480 to 430 BCE. He does the statue of Zeus at Olympia. Zoop. And it was Zeus. It was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, so not actually bad. He does later on get in trouble. I don't want to ruin this, but he does later on get in trouble for portraying himself and Pericles on the shield of one of those statues that he was working on, either Athena or Zeus. And because he was friends with Pericles, and Pericles had a lot of political enemies, they're actually able to charge Phidias, and he goes to jail. And I think at some point he's either killed or he's allowed to starve to death. So, but he was, from what I could gather, an incredible artist. I don't get all of the how it's connected to what Leo was being accused of in this story, but he was an incredible artist in his own right, a sculptor.
Well, I think he's just just a great artist. It's like two great artists having a conversation in this book. But Phidias is often credited as the guy who instigated classical Greek sculpture. He's considered by most scholars and historians to be the greatest of all the ancient Greek sculptors. Not only did the statue of Zeus at Olympia that you mentioned, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, he also designed the statues of Athena that went up on the Acropolis, the Athena Parthenos inside the Parthenon, and the Athena Promachos, which was a huge bronze statue of Athena, which stood between the Parthenon and the Propylaea, the sort of gateway as you go up to, as you walk up, you remember the walk up to the Acropolis.
Oh yeah.
You go through this gateway. It's still there, and you know, it's crumbled. The rest of it, but it's still there. Anyway, in this story, in this book written by Lomazzo, Phidias asks Leonardo if he and Sally were having sex. Did you perhaps play with him that backside game that Florentines love so much? Leonardo responds, many times. You should know that he was a most beautiful young man, especially at about 15. So that might be a suggestion about when their relationship started. You're not ashamed to say this? Asks Phidias. Leonardo replies, why ashamed? Among men of worth, there is scarcely greater cause for pride. Understand that masculine love is solely the product of merit, which joins together men of diverse feelings of friendship so that they may, from a tender age, arrive at manhood as stronger friends. Which is exactly what you told me in Vegas. There's nothing to be ashamed of.
This bring us closer. Shh, Cam. Shh. Yeah. It's okay. This will bring us closer together.
What? No. And it has. We're still together. Right. This relationship has lasted longer than most of my marriages.
Yes. I do have to ask because, you know, if you read enough over the years, you do come across this idea that an older man takes a younger man and he teaches him about the world. He teaches him things. He gets him ready for adulthood. He gets him ready to navigate the waters of adulthood. But at the same time, he's stooping him because it's just a, you know, before puberty, basically the male and female body is practically the same. It doesn't look much different. But it's like,
There's one slight difference.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, as far as general, you know, there's no breasts and there's not much sticking out. It's just skin and bones and skinny kids. But some people find that hot. No, but I've never understood when some people argue that relationship is somehow so special, it's almost superior or more pure than what a man and woman can have who are roughly the same age and they're equals and it's consensual or whatever. Whereas when I've ever heard this kind of relationship, I'm like, does the boy really have a choice? Is he being manipulated or whatever? So I was never comfortable with it. But we have to remember, this is not Leonardo replying to this. This is the writer putting words in Leo's mouth. So take it with a grain of salt.
Yes. Yeah. But, I mean, as I said, this writer was friends with one of Leonardo's students, so he's probably got the inside track on Leonardo's views about this.
Or at the very least, it was either common knowledge what Leo was doing, or at the very least, there were rumors of what was going on, and someone would obviously write about that or talk about that or assume that it was true. So there's some talking going on, whether it's true or not, who knows, but it seems from what we can gather from Leo, it seems to be true. In whatever form, whenever they started, there does seem to be a physical relationship between these two.
And this is, you know, very Catholic Milan, where this is a crime, punishable by death, same sex, whether it's with a 15-year-old boy or another. And yet there's no indication that Leonardo ever got in trouble for this.
Right.
So you would have to assume that people knew what was going on. And he's a very public figure and he's much loved, but everyone's like, you know, no, who cares?
Yeah.
Really? Yeah. Let's just let Leonardo be Leonardo.
You do
Sally.
But
yeah.
You do. Like who? Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. He's not married. He's in his 60s.
Yeah.
He's either just low sexual energy or
and
gay.
He talks,
and it's okay. And he talks, I'm just a southern man who likes other southern man's penises. Yeah, yeah. That's all.
That's not gay. That's just southern.
So anyway, yeah.
Yeah. So soon after Sally moves in with Leonardo, he gets his nickname. Leonardo writes, literally, I've read this part of his notebook. He says, Sally moved in with me. On the second day, I had two shirts cut out for him, a pair of hose and a leather jacket. And when I put aside some money to pay for these things, he stole the money. I could never make him confess, although I was quite certain of it. So the little devil, literally, day two, he's stealing money from Leonardo.
Is he defective? What? He's 10 years old and he's stealing money.
Well, yeah, now, he's like an Oliver Twist, man, or whatever that is. A Pinocchio. He's just a little, you know, a little thief.
A little scamp. But here's a... At what point does Leonardo grab him by the back of his collar and the back of his pants and throw his ass out the door? Don't land until you get home, motherfucker. Mm. You've caused me too much trouble. As we're going to see, that never happens. So this, again, to me, that's an indication. This is not a normal teacher-student relationship. Leo's putting up with a lot of shit because maybe he's getting some on the side. Who knows?
Yeah. Kids do stupid shit. Kids steal. Yep. Kids lie. You know, you go, well, he's a kid. But Sally kept this up for his entire life. Apparently.
Yeah, I'm a scam.
Leonardo just put up with it. And it's love. Love's love. What are you going to do?
Love's love. Exactly.
So... very soon after Sally moves in, Leonardo starts taking him to dinner parties as his companion, which indicates he was probably more than just a student or a pupil early on. There was something special Leonardo saw in him from very early on. 2 days after he moved in, Leonardo took him to dinner at the home of the architect Giacomo Andrea da Ferrara. Where Leonardo later writes in his notebook, Sally supped for 2 and did mischief for 4, for he broke 3 cruets and spilled the wine.
Just sit there. Fucking sit there. Sorry.
Yeah, God, I can relate. I can relate to that.
That's all you gotta do. Yeah.
So you can imagine that the people were like sending Leonardo dinner party invitations up there, like, listen, we love you. You're great. You're the best. On the other hand, bring the kid?
Stay outside.
Yeah.
Whatever. Yeah. But here's the thing for me, and we're going to list a couple of these, but like you said, Sly is going to do this for the rest of his life because either he was mentally defective, didn't care, or he knew he had a sweet ass and can get away with anything. But the point is, Leonardo is going to more and more and more write about these instances in his notebooks, but it's not like anger, like, fuck you, I wish you would die, get the hell out of my house, right? This is the last straw. He seems to be observing these things that Sly does with amusement and affection. He's like, oh, you little scamp, I can't wait to tag that ass again. But there's a lot of tolerance where there shouldn't have been unless there was some kind of relationship other than teacher and student. Mm. He's tolerating this kid. You know, way too much.
People have asked me for years, why do you put up with Ray? He does no work. He's lazy. Right. He's stupid.
Well, and I'm like, I pretend
love is love. What are you getting?
Thank you. Thank you for backing me up, Cam. I really.
I go, yes, all of what you said is true. However, you know,
I'm going to tell you.
He has compromising photos of me, and he threatens to release them if I don't.
That was night one in Vegas. So yeah, I've been chilling ever since then. No, I was going to say, but I'm a little older than you, so this won't make sense. But it was Pompey who said to Sulla, "What did he say? Something like when Sulla was giving him a hard time, and they kind of first met. Pompey said something like the people or the universe." Follows the rising sun and not the falling sun. You know, it's like Sulla was getting old. Pompey was still in his 20s. But since I'm a couple of years older than you, that doesn't really work. I'll just stick with the compromising photos. So
I should have had that hotel room swept for bugs. I knew it from the get-go.
I did. And then I had my bugs put in. But so.
Now, we know Leonardo didn't talk much about his personal life in his notebooks, but he does mention Sally dozens of times. And sometimes it's with amusement and affection. Sometimes it's with frustration and exasperation. And there's at least 5 mentions of him stealing things, including one like this. He said, on the 7th day of September, he stole a stylus worth 22 soldi from Marco, who was staying with me. It was of silver, and he took it from his studio. And when Marco had searched for it a long time, he found it hidden in the box of Giacomo. That's Sally.
Right.
During the wedding pageant for Ludovico Sforza and Beatrice in 1491, Leonardo wrote, when I was in the house of Messer Galeazzo da San Severino to arrange the festival for his tournament, and certain footmen had undressed to try on some of the costumes of the savages which were to appear at the festival,
Right.
Giacomo went to the wallet of one of them as it lay on the bed with other clothes and took out whatever money he found there.
Dick.
Now, you got to wonder why he's writing this down in his notebooks to begin with. Like, he doesn't expect anyone to read these. Why is he writing this stuff down? Right. His notebooks aren't a diary. He's not like Dear Diary. He's not doing a whole... fucking Jewish girl who died. What was her name? He's not Anne Frank or... Right. Under the bell jar. Who wrote the bell jar? Sylvia Plath. Yes. He's not Sylvia Plath. He's not Anne Frank. He's not writing things in these notebooks as a diary. I don't know why he's writing this down. Maybe just to get it off his chest.
I think that's the way he internalized everything, or his process worked. I think if it meant anything to him, good or bad, he's going to write it down in his valued notebooks. But yeah, but in some ways, it almost makes him look like an ineffectual teacher. But again, he's just recording all these things, and there's no point. Today was the last straw. I kicked him out. I'll never see him again. What a waste of 5 years. You know, nothing like that. Just, he did this, and still going on. Yeah.
He wrote, Maestro Agostino of Pavia, it's Augustus, I think, Agostino, isn't it? Gave me a Turkish hide in order to make a pair of boots, and Giacomo stole it from me within a month and sold it to a cobbler for 20 soldi, and with this money, by his own confession, he bought aniseed candy.
I take back what I said on the last episode. Leonardo is not the king of side hustle. Sully is. So he's making money left and right off other people's stuff. But this kid, it's like he knows all the pawnbrokers in town because he's stealing shit and he's taking it to him.
There's one accounting entry in one of Leonardo's notebooks. And in the margins, in big writing that's scrawled, he writes, Ladro, bugiardo, ostinato, ghiotto, which means thief, liar, obstinate, greedy. Which we assume is he's talking about Sally. And this continued for years and years and years. There's a shopping list that Leonardo dictated to an assistant in 1508.
Mm-hmm.
So this is 18 years after Sally moved in. And then it sort of dissolves into Leonardo writing, Sally, I want peace, not war. No more wars, I give in.
Wow. Well, you saw that movie years ago, Lolita, with Jeremy Irons, right?
Haven't seen the film, but I just read the book.
Okay, well, basically... Sally has figured out very early on who's got the power. He does. I mean, this guy, he can do whatever he wants, and he does. He does horrible things, and he's embarrassing Leonardo in public. But Leonardo, again, just writes about it, complains about it, occasionally bitches and bursts out in his book like you just read. But the kid's not going anywhere. And they've been together for 18 years. They're an old married couple. They're an old gay married couple at this point in Florida. So he's not going anywhere.
Actually, the Lolita reference is a perfect one because that's exactly sort of the relationship that the protagonist in Lolita, whose name I can't recall. I know it's something repeated twice. Oh, yeah, Humbert. It just came to me. Humbert talks about in the novel, Lolita is just irascible from the get-go. Moody, grumpy, just bitches and moans all the time and wants stuff. And he kind of has almost this, she's like the bad child that he has this quasi-parental relationship with, and he's always trying to discipline her and, give her what she wants to calm her down, stop her tantrums. But at the same time, he's fucking her because she's 13 and hot in his eyes. Yeah. Right. He can't get enough of it.
Exactly. Keeps drawing him in.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, he's just obsessed with teenage, pre-pubescent girls. That's the perfect age for him, is sort of 12, 13, just on the verge of puberty. That's his perfect window. Can't get enough of it. Unlike Lolita and Humbert, though, she does leave him. And yes. He doesn't find her, I think, for like 10 years in the book. He spends 10 years trying to track her down.
Jeez, that's an obsession.
Then she finally contacts him, and he goes to see her, and she's married to some redneck, and she's got a kid, and she needs money, and you know, she's shacked up with some dude.
And he feels like he's betrayed. Jeez, yeah, warp story.
A little bit, because he thought it was like this sort of great romantic love that they had, but for her, he realizes that in her eyes, so he sort of realized that a lot, in her eyes, he was just a dirty old man that was having his way with her, and she just put up with it to, you know, get by. Jesus. Anyway, these guys stayed together for decades, but, you know, Leonardo continued to put up with it, even though Sally never grew out of being an annoying dick. Leonardo would dress him up in colourful clothes, many of them pink.
Right.
Read into that what you will. And they cost a lot of money, according to his notebooks. Yes. At least 24 pairs of fancy shoes and a pair of stockings so expensive they must have had jewels embroidered in them were recorded in his notebooks.
No one's ever gotten me jeweled anything. Anything. Socks, condom, under anything. I'm sorry.
And we will talk more about Sally as the series goes on, but they were together until I think 1518. He dies in 1524, aged about 43, 44. Mm-hmm. Leonardo dies in 1519. So not long after he and Sally go their separate ways. But Sally did do a couple of paintings. I talked about one of them before, I think, on the show. There's his version of the Mona Lisa called the Mona Vanna, which is a nude version of the Mona Lisa.
Can't do that.
And he also did a version of the Salvator Mundi, the Savior of the World painting. Mm-hmm. There's a drawing of Angelo Incarnato by Leonardo that's sort of the basis of that. So he did a couple of paintings you were aware of. I mean, scholars say they're not very good, but, you know, if I could paint like that, you'd never fucking hear the end of it. That's the your introduction to Sally, and I think that's where we'll leave this episode. What do you think?
All right, sounds good.
All right, have a good week, folks. We'll be back with more Leonardo soon, sooner than you can believe it.